Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is episode 2. This episode we read Henri Fayol's General and Industrial Management, chapter 4. To get the text and for more information, go to www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. This is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
And this is Ralph, coming to you from Norfolk, Virginia in the United States.
This is Pedro, coming to you from Berlin.
This is Miranda, coming to you from Leamington Spa.
Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Indeed. This time we read just part of a book, and it's been really interesting. So I think we might come back to Fayol at some point in the future. But the part we did read, the 14 principles, I have really mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, it's really clear and well-written. And by the way, for the benefit of listeners, the supplement this week is an outline of the chapter, so you can just listen to that if you don't want to read the 20 pages or so. But at the same time, there were some things that he clearly, in my opinion, overlooked due to how high he was in the organization that he was at the time.
It's interesting because I also have quite mixed feelings, and maybe for a different reason. I think that what I was a bit unsatisfied in a way of the reading is that it seems that he gives a set or a description of what an ideal condition for management to take place would be like, but he never really explains what they are, the way to get there. So it's almost like he is setting up the requirements, but it doesn't really say the path to get there. But on the other hand, what I really liked about the reading was that I was a bit surprised with the refined social science understanding that he has, because of course he's not a social scientist, I think he's an engineer, if I'm not mistaken. And in many places he seems to describe the relevance of many organizational elements, from setting up work tools or designing organizational structures in a way to accomplish something, which is something that seems very in line to general organizational theory as we have today.
Well, if I can add, the idea of mixed feelings probably is what I should have used to describe my reaction to the reading. There are definitely some positive things, especially in light of the previous reading, the reading by Taylor. So there is this sense of like moving away from the one best way to something that is, to a solution that is different according to the different situations. So this was definitely one thing I liked. On the other hand, there were a lot of ideal things and not a real explanation on how to get to them. And a lot of it was definitely from the point of view of the manager. And I found this quite unusual, especially given the importance to experience. So I had some thoughts on that point.
I shared the group concerns about there's pluses and minuses to the things he wrote about. I think, like both Miranda and Pedro, that I think there was the path to get there, or how you actually decide how to balance things. I mean, many of the items he says, you have to do all these things, and then it requires balance and judgment, and I don't know if that really helps anybody. For example, you have to have people with high ethics, and they have to be very honest. I mean, some of them come across to me almost like platitudes, because, yes, we know you have to do stuff like that. But he doesn't really describe, well, how would you look for that? Or would, you know, how do you see that managers or the selection process or anything like that? And on the other hand, many of the things he describes doing, the staff coordination meetings and having high regard for people and fairness, I've seen many times in my career as a practitioner worked very well. And I particularly liked his emphasis. He moved away from sort of Taylor's rigid focus on pay for performance and that's the thing that motivates people. And I'm sure it does. It provides some motivation, but I always think I keep thinking about Maslow and the fact that, okay, once you get pay above a certain level, it's not really further motivating for people. And so I like the way Fayol talks about esprit de corps as his, you know, amongst his 14 principles. And then last thing I really liked was, if you look at his management elements, which were in chapter three that we didn't read, but in conjunction with his 14 principles, it's a very powerful system of items that work very well together. They're very reinforcing. So that's what I liked about the fact that you try to come up with a comprehensive set of ideas. And I'm not so sure I saw the fact that, or the perspective, and maybe I just was missing it, that he was excessively from the focus of senior management. Because remember, he came up through the ranks. So it may be that he's writing most recently of his experience as a senior manager, but he had many management jobs before he became the senior manager, and many of the principles apply wherever you are in the organization. It's just how you apply them. And of course, that's left up to judgment and left up to the reader. And I think I thought it was interesting, but it doesn't give you much guidance, like Pedro was saying, for how to actually do some of those things.
I was actually curious, Dimitri just said this thing about, it seems that many things that he said is because his position, and Miranda was also saying something about, you know, having this as the point of view of the manager. How do you think that influenced maybe the work? Because it was not very clear for me when you said it.
The work as in the reading?
Yeah.
You mean how it's how it comes up?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Okay, well, just before I go into that, there's one thing that Ralph said that I really want to get at before we move away, is about manager being almost a good man. That this really came through repeatedly, and for instance, on page 22, he actually says that personal integrity and high moral character is required for someone to be a good manager, so the good manager becomes a good man, in his view, which is mm-hmm. very interesting. And it is related to his chief executive position within the mining corporation, in that he persistently gives the idea of an organization almost as a single unitary body. It's a biological metaphor. And mm-hmm. this is something that we refer to as these days as a unitarist perspective on organizing. So Taylor was there as well with the one best way, just to define the unitarist perspective as something that advocates coherence and harmony within the organization. So everything is integrated with a common purpose and a shared goal, and it's quite paternalistic, to be fair. And the employees are expected to be loyal to the firm and the management, and in return, management is expected to, you know, be morally upstanding and improve their livelihood. Where I'm going with this is that he, through these 14 principles, repeatedly advocates an idea that everyone needs to be going in the same direction. And mm-hmm. The downside of this is that there is no conflict, and if there is, it's irrational, or it's just insane, or people are saboteurs or misguided. So everyone needs to go in the direction of the organization. And for Fayol, being so high up the hierarchy, that would in effect mean everyone needs to follow what he says. And that's why I said the thing that I said about the position of seniority influencing these principles.
Now that could, there is some of that there, but I think you may be reading a little bit too much into the everything's harmony and everybody does what I say, because he talks later when he talks about the coordination meetings and how people should be organized, that people should have the initiative and the willingness to speak up and tell the boss things he doesn't know. He does mention that. I'll have to look up the page number where he talks about that. So I think you have a good point that a lot of this, there's that aspect of harmony and everybody should kind of be moving in the same direction. And he doesn't really address how you would manage, whether conflict would occur and how you would manage it. But I wasn't so sure that I got the sense it was pretty much everybody had to follow the direction of the senior executive. Because the meetings he describes, coordination meetings he describes later in the book, are not all about just following what the boss wants.
Oh, no. I may have overstated my point. I mean, that would make him Taylor, right?
Yes.
If it was just follow what I say. Right. It is the entity of the organization, the body of the corporation, the esprit, the core, right? That is what everyone is supposed to follow. But in practice, the strategic direction is established by the senior management. That's why, in effect, it is that everyone should indirectly follow him. And whilst employees should, as you pointed out, tell their superiors things they may not know, it seems to me that they ought not disagree with them.
I think there are two things actually there which are very interesting that, in a way, that you're saying and Ralph is saying, is that one is when he talks about manager, maybe he implies the high level in a way, because many things that he talks about, like about pay and everything, are things that not middle manager or product managers can actually deal with. It's much more something that is at the top of the corporation, I would think. So I think that's one thing. But also, as per this unitarist, more organic view that he has, it makes me think that he takes as given that things are ought to be organic and they are usually just like that, which is something that I don't really agree, because I think that normal life, including inside organizations, usually we have a lot of conflict, a lot of disagreements. And actually the task, as I see, the challenge is to bring these conflicts and disagreements into some level of agreement and coherence. So it seems really that he starts at an odd position, and then he never really explains how you get there.
Right, I agree. I think that's too simplistic, because I think he's talking about the ideal case, and whether it comes from the senior manager or is the directors or something like that, this sort of unity of purpose. I think conflict is, it's important for organizations to manage that. And I think he completely leaves out how you would do that or how you would surface those kinds of things or make it safe. And I think that's when you look at organizations that get into trouble or lose their way strategically, it often is because they don't manage conflict or nobody wants to surface something where they don't agree with the boss, or it becomes undiscussable to talk about problems with a plan, and he doesn't address it at all.
I think there's also another curious aspect that the idea of moral character isn't actually defined. And it's quite interesting because towards the end of the text, there's kind of like a question that he asks, wouldn't it be enough to go back to the higher laws of religious and moral order? And then he mentions, but this isn't the case because we're not dealing with interests of the entire society, but economic interests. So to a certain extent, all this recalling upper values of morality and so on kind of start to crumble. At least that's how I saw it. And in addition to this, I think that one interesting thing is that this text kind of like takes for granted that economic interests are the primary interest of the firm. So other interests that we actually have and are defining firms nowadays and are giving light to interesting streams of research, like, I don't know, social entrepreneurship or family businesses, do not come into the picture.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, Miranda, that he's very much a man of his age. So talk about these religious and societal values and those kind of things, where there was a lot more unity then. And we tend to value diversity more now. And I think I thought it was really interesting. So you talk about esprit de corps. And sure, sometimes that can be around managing money. But I like what you're talking about with this. It's almost, I was thinking about today, it's almost where some of the most successful businesses try to connect to people's sense of purpose, you know, going beyond money. I mean, money, sure, you have to have some floor level of money, but there are other things that motivate people today. And many companies are looking to tap into that because they think their perspective is, and there's quite a bit of research on this, that it makes people more productive.
It's interesting, this thing that just say towards the end of the text when he talks about his moral books, because it seems to me that although he's referring to that, he's actually trying to say that he, in a way, should not need to abide by those things, because since you're talking about, I was concentrating more on the fact you should focus on the association of individuals and less on the individual, and less with the thing that he says later, which is the economic interest versus other kind of interest. Because there, I think there is something very relevant, which is why you need organizational theory in the first place. You know, that you're trying to understand things that are an effect of associations among people. So it's a group level. There are some dynamics that only exist in the group level, which if you just try to have an individual base, very psychology or cognitive oriented one, explanation, you're going to just don't be able to grasp. And I think, as Ralph was talking about the spirit of corpse idea, I think it's very fascinating because he breaks that down in a way, not in a very HR psychology-oriented thing, but he's more talking about organizational design almost, how you have to design the different departments and whether you should use writing or not to communicate, so which kind of tools you use to communicate across groups, which is a different way to think of how do you build this coherence, you know, so specific tools to do that.
Yeah, well, one caveat is that it's not organizational theory, it's the theory of management that he was advocating. And the distinction, I think, at least to me, is important in that the agency is translated to those who are supposed to manage and organize and command and control and do all the other things that he proposes. So he may be concerned with structuring organizations beyond the whiteboard level, but I think he is definitely more concerned with raising and educating a staff of officers, if you will, to help him run this huge company.
My only conflict, I agree fully, but the only thing that I felt is that many things that he says are not really up to most managers actually to deal with, if you follow me. You know, so I don't know if it's just such as the issues related to pay, for instance. You know, I don't think that managers today are, if you think of middle manager, product managers, they're not really the ones that can decide what mode of pay they're going to use. I don't know if that's something that was, I don't know, managers have a stronger role back then, or...
I think we have a more homogeneous idea of how to pay people, because in that section he gives these three or four categories of remuneration, which in the end all come down to paying people for the time. But these days we sort of take it for granted, more or less. So maybe that's why. What do you think?
Well, I think because he was in a big organization, they probably had standard ways of doing that, you know, in a 1,000-person company. But I don't know. We may be reading too much into that. But I'd like to go back to Pedro's observations about the esprit de corps, and I completely agree with you. One of the things that I thought was very contemporary, very modern for somebody who was writing in the, you know, the last century, was he talks about under esprit de corps, and I'm not quite sure why he put it there, but he did. He talks about abuse of written communications. I thought that was great, because you could even describe in text messages and emails and all sorts of stuff now. And I've actually been in organizations where somebody is across the hallway from you and sends you an email to ask you to go do something. And some organizations, you know, people don't want to get up from their desk and walk over and talk to somebody. And so there are organizations where you have to, I mean, many organizations you have to have a balance, right? Sometimes you have to have a record of what was said and done, and I mean, there's a role for meeting minutes, but there's also a role for going in and just, you know, talking to people and communicating orders that way. So I thought... I never heard that called abuse of written communications before, so I'm going to use that because I think that's pretty good.
Actually, I love that part. I think it's like it's the little jewel in the text, because for my PhD, so I have done a long case study in a product development department, and I think I interviewed almost like 100 engineers, product managers, technicians, and they all stress that the core thing to make interdependence happen and to make the different groups that all work in the same product work better, to make the things, to avoid disagreements and problems, is exactly to just go and speak with the person. But for some reason, everyone insists on sending email, and no matter what they do, it's really hard to nurture people to realize it's important to just go over someone's other desks. And it's interesting that I remember that has, because one might say that, you know, this is something for the past, because nowadays you have firms with teams distributed across the globe, people working everywhere. And I remember there was some research by someone from Stanford about global teams, I think it's Pamela Haynes. And she says that visits of one team to other team helps a lot to nurture connections and build better understandings. So even there is like still the idea that you really have to make people talk to each other face to face.
I actually think this is like the most modern aspect of the text by far. Because then there's another part where he talks about how the manager should take care of the environment and the atmosphere of the company. But there he goes into more... concrete aspects, nothing that is really kind of like social or emotional, so more the hygiene, the order, the spaces, these kind of things, but nothing that today you would expect something going into, I don't know, social dynamics or fostering teamwork, these kind of things. So in that there's a balance probably within the text, something a bit more modern, something not that modern.
Miranda, there was something that you said at the beginning that I think I didn't really quite... I agree, but I was curious to know more. Is that you said that you see a difference between him and Taylor, as we read before, that he doesn't necessarily imply that there is one best way to be found.
Yeah, I think that is one thing that is repeated different times within the text. So I found it quite curious. I mean, one of the opening paragraphs is, seldom do we have to apply the same principle twice in identical conditions. But then when you read throughout the text, even though it is openly stated, it isn't developed. So it's something probably some ideal that he was aspiring for, but concretely wasn't actually explained pragmatically and in the details. At least that was my feeling about it.
I think you're completely right about that, Miranda. I thought the same thing. He starts to talk about that, and then he just drops it immediately. So my practitioner the practitioner in me wants to say, hey, give me some more details, or what are some of these things you're balancing, or something like that. And I think because he was writing about hygiene and fitness and stamina and stuff, and I was thinking, well, what does that mean? Does that mean everybody does exercises in the morning? Does that mean you give people breaks? I mean, he did have something where I thought he was concrete about a couple of things where he said people should take vacations and they need time off and those kinds of things. I thought that was good. I mean, that's very modern for his time.
Could it be that the difference between him and Taylor is that through years of managing organizations, Fayol noticed that organizations consist of people?
It's funny when you say it like that.
Well, I think Taylor saw it the same way, but I think he was Taylor had a kind of a mechanistic focus on motivation and what people want at work. And I think Fayol goes beyond that. I mean, you can see that throughout his principles where he's talking about discipline and integrity and all these other things. So yeah, it's the people part really does come forward clear, because you read Taylor and you keep thinking, does he think he's managing people or robots? I mean, what does he think is going on?
With Taylor is that he, as we discussed in episode one, he really wanted to help, but that would come at the price of stripping down pretty much everything that would make one human. With Fayol, he seems to recognize that people are uneven and they may be frictionless. Is that a word?
Frictionless. How about just friction?
That, you know, all the good, the bad, and the ugly of individual persons. And this is something I really, really liked in Fayol's work. And to me, this is the main and the key point how he is different from Taylor, that he recognized the people with a capital P, if you will, within the organizations.
I think you're right, but he does have some Taylor tendencies, right? Because I'm looking at principle number 3, where he's talking about discipline, right? So it's obedience, application, energy, behavior, and outward marks of respect, right? So very hierarchical and maybe a tad authoritarian, where that's one of the areas where you'd like to see, okay, well, how do you manage conflict? And isn't some level of conflict good? And if somebody, don't you want somebody to speak up if they think that there's a process in place that's keeping them from producing good work or something like that? And he doesn't address any of that stuff. And so it's a little mixed, as you guys were saying earlier, where I see, okay, sometimes he's talking about speaking up or communicating, other times it's about obedience, right? And that's a difficult thing to balance.
You know, I read that principle number 3 as organization, that my book does say discipline as yours do, but I read it in terms of organizing a body of people into an effective production force.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I want to go back a bit with what you just said, Dimitri, is that I think the difference with Taylor and Fayol is that in Taylor, they're almost like he's looking at job design. So I think his idea is that if you design work tasks in a way, people would just need to do it that way and there would be no problems and so on and so forth. Whereas, to go back to what you said before, also, you know, given maybe his position in the organization, he's actually looking for organization design, so structure. So it's not really talking about specific tasks. So it creates a different focus.
I think there's also one thing that is important to highlight, that yes, Fayol is getting to kind of like a view of employees as people, but at the same time, in his vision, they are still motivated primarily by money, by economic interests. And that is something questionable in the definition of employees as people, in my opinion.
I may have missed that completely, but does he ever articulate a more or less coherent proposition as to what motivates people in any one place? I thought he sort of just sweeps it under the carpet or takes it for granted.
I don't think he did it clearly like we would like to see, but there's elements of it in the esprit de corps, because he's, you know, if the things like harmony and the union of personnel, if those just came automatically, That would be one thing. So I think he's implying there's things you have to do. And he also talks about fairness and equity. So it's not, he doesn't come right out and say it's sprinkled in many of the areas. And it's possible I'm reading too much into it. So I was not, from a modern perspective, I thought that was lacking. But once again, I think he's sort of a man of his age where they didn't really spend a lot of time, senior managers didn't spend a lot of time thinking about stuff like that. Not that I know.
I think the discussion of motivation and money is very interesting because if I understand, the industry he was for the most part was mining. And if I remember well, there is this classic book in organizational sociology, which is Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy, in which Alvin Gardner studied a gypsum plant or a mining corporation, something along those lines. And one of the things he says is exactly that one of the problems of trying to implement a very bureaucratized system in the mining, especially like in the, in the factory part, but more inside the mining parts of the factory, is that the people working there not only value the money, they value a lot of the autonomy. And the managers there, the foremen that they work for, they understand that. So they are much less stringent than managers in other parts of the factory when about absence, when just like the workers decide not to go for work. And also there's not the same kind of organization that there is in a typical industrial factory. So I think that it seems fitting because there is research that shows that in that kind of context, money is not the only thing, apparently.
I don't know if he ever articulates, as Ralph pointed out, positive features of motivating people, but he does go on about negative features. This reminded me a lot of Hertzberg hygiene factors, that as long as there is no laziness and no abuse on part of management, and everyone is observing the unity of direction, then it should be okay. Or did I completely misinterpret this? He doesn't say do this and that, but he does say that try not to do these other things if you want an efficient and motivated organization.
I think I did pick up on the presence of a lot of negative aspects. For instance, a lot of the discussion is on the presence or the use of sanctions, and I thought that quite strange because what you actually hear nowadays is not the use of sanctions and of punishments, but of incentives. So there is definitely a negative line that is throughout certain parts of it.
I agree, Miranda. That struck me quite a bit when he was talking about the sanctions. And I think there are, organizations, you have to have some idea of standards and holding people accountable. So I think that is something that is common to organizations. But I would have been much more pleased, I think, as you would have been, to see some more about, well, how else do you motivate people? Because I think they all seem to take it for granted. And that may be because, as you were saying earlier, Dimitri, he comes at this from a senior manager position and doesn't really address what the interests of the line level worker.
I want to play a bit of devil's advocate. Because I was wondering about my impressions of the text and my notes, and at certain points, I feel that the way he talks about workers is almost like he is subscribing to what today would call probably empowerment. Because I saw that in two points. In one is when he's talking about responsibility, I think, and he says that the real thing is about infusing a sense of courage for responsibility with people. And there's another point that I think is even more clear, is when he's talking about how are two workers that belong to different groups to work together, and he says that the typical organizational way would be to go all the way up the ranks, and and the manager should be he talks about these things about how you should go up the whole chain, up and then down, so this worker can be connected to the other one. But he says they're actually not the best. I mean, it's not very ideal. Ideally, the two workers would just speak with each other. So the best thing would be able to just get the managers of these guys to agree, or girls to agree, and then they could directly interact. So there's a lot of thing, like empowering towards, let's leave it to them. You don't need to involve the whole hierarchy on this, which is...
I love it that you put girls in there in a 19th century French mining operation.
I'm a feminist. Sometimes I have to do what I have to do.
No, you're just trying to update it for the current world. I'm okay with that. And Pedro, I think that was a really good point. And the other principle I want to bring up that I think helps illustrate your point is number 11, where he talks about equity. And he's talking about the combination of kindness and justice. So he is looking out, has some respect for the workers or some thoughts about that. It once again, doesn't say how to do it, but mm-hmm. I think, and then the other one he talks about in 12, stability of tenure personnel. I love that one because he's talking about letting people stay in their job long enough to get good at what they do, right? And mm-hmm. I think that's has dual benefit. In that, A, it helps the organization, but it also helps the person become more effective, and he writes about that. So I think those are good points you brought up.
I'm just looking at the 11 and 12. 11 is two paragraphs long.
Oh yeah, of course it's like tiny equity. Compared to discipline or responsibility.
it's actually telling, I think, that the longest single section, as far as I remember, in this whole chapter is one on pay.
Yep.
Yeah,
with multiple subsections, and so perhaps that is an indirect evidence to what he thought was most important, or perhaps just what he knew best.
I think it's a little bit of both, mm-hmm. and I think it was common for that time. People, I think it's a fairly modern concept. This idea that people work for more than just pay. I mean, Maslow wasn't writing what he wrote until after World War II, I think, and up until that time. People thought, well, you just come to work, you get your paycheck, and you go. And some kinds of work are appropriate for men, and some kinds for women, those things shouldn't cross. And so I think we had a big transformation in our ideas about work after World War II, and we saw this big influx of women into the workforce, and discovered that these sort of cultural limits or biases we had about what kind of work they could do weren't really valid anymore. So I know I'm way off topic, but I couldn't resist that.
What I was struck in that section, more than the whole discussion whether people work for money or not and the extent, I think it was, in a way, he describes this organization, this corporation, as if he was completely independent of all the other system. You know, it's like it's this island and he...
Oh, that was going to be my point.
Oh, go sorry, go I stole it. You can build on that. But he hints at the whole idea of no capital and labor and almost like collective bargaining and all these things that comes around. Unions, maybe, but it doesn't really. He almost says that it's something like under the rug. He doesn't really acknowledge or say how to do it and what's the point. So what is your point, sorry, Dimitri?
Well, I saw it from a slightly different perspective, which probably goes back to our different ontological epistemological positions. that was a mouthful.
Yeah, it's getting deep now.
I know. So the way I saw it is that he perceived, well, justly so, for him, the mining corporation and any other similar, this classical corporation as we understand them, mm-hmm. they existed almost in a state of near monopoly in that there was no market competition. These 14 principles, the way I saw them, are geared exclusively for keeping the organization afloat. So it's a survival guide, but there is nothing there that would explain how to innovate or, granted, it's mining, so the scope is limited, but still. Mm-hmm. In turning around this company, he invested in research and development, but it's not here. So he doesn't see it as a function of management, I suppose, which is, I think, comes back to that in that time, in that industry, you wouldn't have market pressures of competition in the same way as we do now.
I just wanted to add on this idea of monopoly and so on, that there is the problem of the company being kind of like guided by the economic interests. So the entire discourse around stakeholder theory, the presence of other stakeholders, isn't taken into consideration. And another kind of general sense from the text that I have is that there is a sense of the firm being very static. I picked it up from your observation of lack of innovation, R&D and so on, in the sense that even it's kind of like it's okay for a world that isn't changing. But if you go to today's world, there are a lot of things that are changing, and people, I don't know, even like when you plan your own career, I'm not sure everyone would be happy to stay in the same position for such a long time. So there's an idea of time that is actually quite different for a variety of reasons.
But what about Deming and the Japanese corporations up until the 90s? That was very much alive there. The idea that you go and you work for the same corporation pretty much for your entire life.
Mm.
I mean, that came from Deming, I think. Ralph would probably correct me if I'm wrong, and Deming got it from Taylor and such other people. So I think that's a direct line of ideological heritage.
Actually, I'm not sure it came straight from Deming, because you can't find that in his 14 points. I think that was more Japanese culture, this idea. And we actually had it in our culture or work culture up until probably the 60s, where you would start with a firm and then you would just stay with that firm for your entire working career. I think in the United States moved away from that in the 60s and 70s time frame, where the markets became more dynamic and the market forces, at least the way the Americans interpret them, went off in this direction of people are interchangeable, and like Miranda was saying, people got used to moving on. So one comment I want to make about the creativity and coming up with new ideas and development, Fayol does address that in, I think, not sufficiently. I think you're right to point out that it's kind of insufficiently addressed. But in Principle 13, he talks about initiative, and he says the power of thinking out a plan and executing, and the freedom proposed to execute. And the initiative all represents a great source of strength for businesses. So he's kind of saying it in general, but goes back to what we've been saying earlier in that, okay, there's all these kind of general high-level statements he's making, but he doesn't really talk about, well, how you would do that, right? So it's one thing to say, and a lot of CEOs will say, oh, I think we want our people to innovate. We want them to be creative, but they don't put structures in place to help them do that or to foster that. And it goes back to, you have these managers where you're relying on all these qualities that, have this list of qualities the manager should have. And if they have these qualities, things will go well. What I thought was lacking in the 14 points is he really doesn't talk about development or selection of personnel. So the development part is in the stability and tenure of personnel. That's part of it. But to me, it's also because of my interest in adult learning. I'm interested in the kind of the Dewey model of giving people problems to work on, developing and come up with new ideas. So I think you can develop if you're in a position for a long period of time, but your manager has to pay attention to things like that, or has to have that as an interest. And he doesn't really address that anywhere in the points that I thought. So I think that it's a very kind of old school, and particularly because this is my dissertation research, I'll put the person in the job for 5 years and they'll just know it at the end, right? And I think there's much more to that about how people learn and giving them varied assignments and that sort of stuff. Quick digression. One of the things that we did in the Navy when we were developing people for working in shipyards is we would specifically look for certain kinds of special problems that might come up. And then we would say, okay, we want to assign this officer to that position, that problem, with a particular team, so that he will get the developmental experience from this. So we used to look for opportunities like that and problems to assign people for development. And I think Fayol doesn't really address any of that stuff.
So you would assign them as a contingency for a problem. So you would create a team to address something that hasn't even surfaced yet.
No, other way around. So what would happen is, We look at problems as opportunities, right? So give you an example, we had a submarine ran into a underwater seamount caused by volcanic activity going 30 knots, and basically stopped from 30 knots in the space of about 150 yards, which is something you never do, and it ripped open the submarine. This was the USS San Francisco. And we had to create a repair team. And so we spent some time thinking not only who should be on the repair team, but also who the leader should be for the developmental opportunity it presented. And you see many things like that where our organization will have some kind of problem. And sometimes, in some organizations, they just always put the best guys on it, right? Well, then who you're developing when we do that? And the organizations I've been in, we always said, okay, who's an up-and-coming leader who could really benefit from this opportunity that we want to assign them there, and also give them some extra help and not just throw them into the fire, but also make sure we gave them a good team, him or her, a good team to support them. And so that's, I think, Fayol doesn't really address that. Just saying, it's very, very indirect through this. And I think it's sort of the old school when you say, oh, yeah, you have to have tenure, personnel, and they'll figure these things out. That's why it takes so long to become an expert, right? Just put somebody in some job and then randomly they develop these experiences over time. So I know I'm kind of reading way more into it than Fayol really intended, but since it's my research area, I couldn't resist bringing it up.
Can I just build on that, on something that you said at the beginning of this beautiful explanation? Is that you were saying something about that he doesn't really talk about personal development or even learning of the workers. Could it be that the manager for Fayol is not necessarily have to know a lot about the work of the workers, unlike for Taylor? So the manager is more a general product manager that really let go into the details of how the work's being carried out?
I think you're right, because he talks about, earlier in the book, he devotes many pages to the fact that he thinks a lot of technical training isn't really needed as managers, and so only kind of at the line working engineer level is all that technical knowledge needed. And even then, it's not needed by all the mathematics is not needed. And he has that wonderful section, I think it's in chapter 3, where he talks about if you're a junior executive or engineer in the company, how you should learn from the workers and get taught by the foreman, which is very similar to the U.S. Navy's training model for officers learning from the senior enlisted. So it really wasn't in this chapter. And I just thought, okay, it was great that he had it in chapter 3, but it's not really reflected in the principles. So I think you're right about that, Pedro.
But that could it be, because now I was thinking about something, is that he said at the beginning of the chapter that he sees the work of managers as a relational work, almost. These are my words, but he said that managers, as different to the other functions, they work through the work of other people. So in a way, could he be, and I go back to the point of empowering, could just he thinks that, you know, managers are supposed to be, you know, a more high level, have a high level look into things and not really be interfering in the job of people? Or maybe I'm just trying to read him in a positive light.
No, I think you're right. He talks about that another place in the book. So, and because he talks about the, when you get more senior, you need to know less and less of that stuff. So I think that's a good point you've observed.
Well, conversely, and again, this isn't in the principles, but in the chapter before, he says that everyone should have at least a little bit of management training. Even the lowest level employee should have like 5% of management training in his skill set. So at the same time as managers should not, it appears, delve too much into technical expertise and work, he proposes a distributed management system where everyone is familiar and has the responsibility for managing the organization. And in fact, first time I ran across Fayol was when I did strategic marketing. And the significance was flagged up as that Fayol thought that marketing is not a departmental function within the organization, but the responsibility of each and every individual who works for an organization.
I like the idea, but isn't that contradictory of the whole point that he was so a strong advocate of the managers and so on as a professional education, a professional group and kind of things?
I think there's also a general problem of how Fayol defines the experience that managers need, which is something that, to be honest, I don't think is adequately discussed within the text. You can pick it up in different parts, but this manager that has moral integrity, intelligence, and experience, the question that I always had when I came across these sentences was, where does it come from? What are we talking about?
Talking about the Übermensch.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Miranda makes a very good point, because when I was reading about all those qualities, I was thinking, oh, this is great man theory in a different form, right? Because he's just listing all these great features. The other thing I wanted to get Miranda's perspective on, because I'm just curious, since your work is in entrepreneurship, it did strike me that a lot of, you know, Fayol talks about these this hierarchy in the organization, how things are, you know, kind of split up, and yet, I would think in smaller firms and firms that are more entrepreneurial, that is not the case. You don't have it split up. There's a lot of cross responsibility and sharing of duties and stuff. I was wondering, how did that strike you, you know, given your research preference?
I was just, one of the main points that I was particularly bothered with was this idea of economic interests prevailing, which also relates to the fact that in firms, there are not only economic interests, but maybe there are the interests of the founder of the idea, of the entrepreneurial idea, of the creature that became a business. But it is true that Fayol limits his attention to managers. So in that sense, he kind of like simplifies the problem. And it's also true that he's talking about one type of firm, which is kind of like this large firm, this historic firm. In that sense, he probably gets out of it. But it is true that if we want to take Fayol to today's business world, we need to add another set of variables, at least in terms of economic interests and stakeholders within the equation.
Can I just go back to the thing of the great man theory or the Übermensch in Dimitri's terms?
Oh, it's not my terms.
I know. I know you wouldn't resist to plug some philosophy.
Yeah, but you brought it up.
Because although I also agree with that, I think, playing a bit of devil's advocate again, is that most of the things that he talks about is not necessarily about the activities of managers, what managers are to do, how is going to the day look like, what the tasks they have to engage, but it's a lot of how is the environment has to be set up so this work can happen. So in a way, he is not really looking at the man or how the man supposed to be, but how is this setting supposed to be designed so the work of managers can go on. So in a way, he's going away of just saying like we need great men to say we need a great environment so this will happen.
Well, and I think that's a good point because there's a lot of other parts of the book talk about that, and it's sort of he's building to that before he gets to chapter 4. So that's the challenge of reading chapter 4 alone and not seeing those other parts of the book. But I'm a little unfulfilled in that he just presents that organization that surrounds a manager as a given in many ways, not how it develops, not how it gets created. And I also wonder, does he think, based on the 14 principles, that the principles sustain that organization? Or because really, I think it doesn't. He does talk about, in other parts of the book, about forecasting and the plan and stuff, which I thought was very interesting because very kind of practitioner-oriented. How do you plan ahead for the future years and stuff? So I thought that was quite good. But he doesn't really address changes that have to occur in the organization as it evolves. I mean, Miranda was talking about this earlier, about how organizations develop and this and the aspect of the founder's ideas and whether there's conflict in that with where the organization is. And Fayol skips over all of that stuff. I mean, the book is short. So, and in fact, I think it was originally published in a magazine or a journal of some kind. So maybe that was for space, but I did feel a little unfulfilled that he didn't go into that further.
So are we interested in something like what would a startup following these 14 principles look like?
I am. I thought because like Pedro said, he almost takes it for granted that this organization or this structure has been created around the managers that they're operating in, and then there's these things they have to go do. And I would have been very interested in how do you build that stuff, or what if you come into an organization and those things don't exist or don't exist that way? What do you do?
Yeah, because otherwise it reads a bit like motherhood and apple pie. Everyone likes it, and everyone's going to agree. But what is the recipe?
I don't know. I find this quite comfortable in terms of either setting up a brand new management infrastructure or coming in a place with one not as developed. I mean, the 14 principles, they ought to guide you towards the right direction. It's same as with Taylor. We're coming back to that principle versus checklist conundrum.
With Taylor, you had a list of principles, but the underlying reasoning was these principles are good because there is science behind them, because there is the one best way, there is the scientific measurement, all these things. What I feel is lacking here is the justifying underlying grand principle, why I should believe these principles. So at the end of the day, he's...
Absolutely.
This is what we should do, but because the manager is the one who knows, who has experience, who has intelligence, who has moral integrity. But the question is this like something objectively true? Can I have faith in this and follow the principles? This is one of my major concerns.
That's a fantastic point. Because while we're occasionally saying that he's not elaborating how any of these can be applied in practice, or at least not giving as much detail as we would like to, my sort of a bone with that, it's not that he's not practitioner enough, he's too practitioner in a way that I did this, so you have to take my word for it because here are my credentials in this mining corporation. However, he does say that he doesn't have all the answers and these are just some things he came up with. But of course, it would be nice to get some more meat on the bone, so to speak.
I was wondering if we're also saying that these principles are actually kind of like, I don't know, a smokescreen, a mask, something to justify the management's actions.
Ah, we're going critical now.
I don't know. Oh. I'm asking.
Well, you have a point. I mean, I think that's a whole level of complexity he just doesn't address. And I just wanted to go back to briefly to what Miranda said about Why should I believe you? You know, where's the science based on this? When I was looking at the article that Pedro sent, it was by Rahman, Hasbur Rahman, and Henry Farrell and Frederick Winslow Taylor's Contribution to Management Thought. So it's an interesting article, and they make the statement in there that they both apply the scientific method. And I felt very unfulfilled by that statement because, like Miranda, I'm saying, well, where's the science about this? I mean, this appeared to work for Fayol, and I think people were hungry to one thing I want to point out that I think is very common between Fayol and Taylor is that both of them later in life spent a lot of their time actually promoting their ideas and, you know, teaching people about them. And I think there was probably a great demand in both societies for what these people had to know. But I felt unfulfilled because about the scientific, you know, background of the scientific method of Fayol. I'm thinking, where? Other than saying, well, he tried these things in practice and sort of kept what worked. Okay, I get that. But I love the way Miranda said it. Why should I believe you? Why should I do what you said? Other than the fact that you had this great personal success, you know, in the mining company.
So if you were to be ironic, it seems that the French guy who is Fayol is the one that is doing the pop management book almost.
yes.
I don't think so.
No?
Because oh. I think he didn't. Right. So there's a nuance there in that I don't think Fayol set out to recreate the scientific management of Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
He builds on it, and there are bits and pieces where he talked about that he observed work could be bottlenecked if a single horse got injured and then you couldn't release a new one without proper authorization, and this was not in the reading, so probably hugely unhelpful. But I sense that building on Taylor's scientific management, or whatever version of scientific management that was popular at the time, and we do know from the episode one that scientific management was circulating, he is adding the human element to the equation, saying that, hey guys, it's not all cogs in the machine, and these people can contribute things, and you need to look at communication and not just, you know, at a two-way communication, not just issuing directives. So I think in that way, I disagree with you.
Okay.
Well, I think the point we were making, though, where I think we actually agree more than you might think. Pedro and I weren't saying he wasn't making a contribution. We were building up what Miranda said, where there's no science in what he was proposing. It's based on his experience, and mm-hmm. and I know he didn't say he was using the scientific method, but that's the remark that Hasbur Rahman made in his paper, and so I was just saying I felt like that science aspect was lacking. I know his intention was different. But mm-hmm. as a organizational scholar and researcher to be, that's what I felt like. Well, where's the evidence for this, other than just saying it worked for you?
No, I get that you want more references in the modern day
yes.
parlay. I think he's making a case study. So it's mm-hmm. an isolated, almost phenomenological recounting of his experience and things that he kept falling back to.
I agree, except unlike Taylor, he didn't give good examples.
Mm. Maybe it's that
I thought it was very much lacking.
Yeah, so maybe.
Sorry, Peter, go ahead.
It's just a matter of, as you were saying before, Dimitrovic, even more meat in the bones. But I want to expand something that you said when you were making this point, is that if we agree that what Fayol was doing is to try to put the people into the picture, still in the text, he's talking a lot about the interaction between manager and workers. I don't see much about workers among themselves.
No, that's not there. But this is an inspiration for a theory of management to be, and as such, as I mentioned in the beginning, it's concerned primarily with managing rather than organizing.
Well, and what I think is interesting that we will see when we cover Chester Bernard is that it appears to me that Fayol wanted to write about things for which there was no theory. And therefore, he had to develop it. So he's, you got to start someplace. And so I'm probably being overly critical by saying not enough references or enough examples. But the practitioner in me wants to see some examples or some sign, some grounding. But that's what I think is very interesting. And one of the things that struck me from the text is Bernard wrote in he actually wrote in 1938 his Functions of the Executive, mm-hmm. which is an interesting parallel or contemporary view of management. And he did the same thing in, you know, because Fayol wasn't published in the United States until 1949. So it shows the benefits of scholarship and publishing and getting your work out there so people can comment on it. Bernard was largely, would appear ignorant of what Fayol was writing about because he hadn't even been published in the United mm-hmm. States up until at the time Bernard wrote 1938. So I just thought that was kind of interesting where there's a lot of good parallels between those two works. One observation I want to make for our practitioner audience is that Fayol didn't really have a general theory of management, and therefore he's using this to develop one. And then I agree with Dimitri and the rest of you, and it's pretty good. I mean, I think he did a pretty good job of surfacing these ideas and having something that works together well. Maybe not, like as Pedro was saying, not what we would expect to see in current scholarship. But the one thing makes me think of Admiral Rickover, for the founder of the nuclear navy in the United States. He also did amazing things to take nuclear power as a as a concept and technology, and then create. He actually his organization was the founder or the one of the helped found the first nuclear power commercial plant, electricity generation plant in the United States, and then what they did to put nuclear propulsion plants on ships, and so great contributions. But I think one of the things I think is a big difference between Rickover and Fayol is Rickover had actually open contempt for management theory and theories of leadership and organizations, and he never systematically documented the principles and ideas that only exist in the fragments of stuff he wrote about. He did write letters and oftentimes letters to the editor, give speeches, but it's only in fragments that you see them. And it's I think that makes it difficult for people. I mean, I think somebody who could have worked for Fayol could have worked on those principles or said, okay, like Dimitri said, I have a pretty coherent plan. You would struggle to do that with the stuff, with the principles Admiral Rickover had because he never articulated them. So that's one thing that I think is really important about what Fayol did. He was trying to get something out there and trying to get something started and also give people some ideas of a path to follow. And when we can say, well, it's not, we would have preferred to do it better. But unlike Rickover, there's something you can follow and comment about. And I think that's a big difference.
That's all for part one of episode 2. Please visit our website www.talkingaboutorganizations.com for information on part 2, future episodes, and show notes. If you enjoyed the first part of this episode, please leave us a positive review on iTunes, subscribe to our feed, and tell your friends about this podcast. You can also get in touch with us on our website, Twitter, Facebook, and on LinkedIn. Thank you, and we hope to see you next week as we conclude our discussion of Henri Fayol and his 14 Principles of General and Industrial Management.